Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Today's opening music comes to us from the Russ Meyer film Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens from 1979. We'll be talking about Meyer's life and times with his biographer during this hour of the program. Good afternoon, this is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Jason Croft. Russ Meyer had a prolific career making exploitation films from the late 1950s through the 1970s and was known for films that featured tough, well-endowed women. One of his most famous films is the cult classic Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, a picture filmmaker John Waters has considered the best film ever made. Released in 1966, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill is basically the story of three go-go dancers who go on a murderous rampage. This is how the film opens.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence, the word and the act. While violence cloaks itself in a plethora of disguises, its favorite mantle still remains sex. Violence devours all it touches, its voracious appetite rarely fulfilled. Yet violence doesn't only destroy, it creates and molds as well. Let's examine closely then this dangerously evil creation, this new breed, encased and contained within the supple skin of woman. The softness is there, the unmistakable smell of female. The surface, shiny and silken. The body yielding yet wanton. But a word of caution, handle with care and don't drop your guard. This rapacious new breed prowls both alone and in packs. Operating at any level, any time, anywhere and with anybody. Who are they? One might be your secretary, your doctor's receptionist, or a dancer in a go-go club.
The opening of Russ Meyer's Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. The life and films of this director are discussed in a new book titled Big Bosoms and Square Jaws, the biography of Russ Meyer, King of the Sex Film. It's written by Jimmy McDonough, and it's published by Crown Books. This is actually an extended interview from one I did for the August edition of Sidetrack. So seeing that this is pre-recorded, we won't be taking calls today. When I talked with McDonough, I first asked him why he portrays Meyer as one of the great movie mavericks.
Well, I mean, a complete original, this guy. I mean, no one was doing what he did before he did it. And he did it with a personal flair that had kind of a touch of madness to it, if you ask me. And it really changed film history. I mean, the idea of combining sexuality, his sense of sexuality, with technical expertise, and just his odd view of the world, it added up to a kind of movie that only he could make and hasn't been seen since, in my opinion.
For those people who aren't familiar with his work, tell us about some of his most famous movies.
Oh, certainly. The first movie that Meyer made a splash with was The Immoral Mr. Tease, which concerned the bumbling adventures of a voyeur who had the magic power to see through women's clothes. You look at this movie today, it's kind of an innocuous piece of piffle. At the time, it was hot stuff, and there was more sort of raw nudity and very kind of exuberant and unapologetic nudity, and it really put America's hair in curlers. And Russ did about, I don't know, 5-6 knockoffs of that. And then in 64, he came back with another kind of picture, Lorna, which was sort of like a grim black and white picture that actually told a story, was heavy on the violence. A real malevolent kind of air permeates the picture. And that began the great period of his black and white pictures, which culminates in a picture that's just beyond belief called Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill, the story of three murderous go-go dancers that are out for blood and money, and has influenced a bevy of filmmakers and rockers. Well, after that comes a color picture called Vixen with Erica Gavin, in which he amped up the sex to a really florid amount and made a picture that made a zillion bucks. And on the basis of the success of that, he was invited over to 20th Century Fox to do a picture scripted by one Roger Ebert, America's famous thumb, called Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and another sort of like Faster Pussycat, a culmination of Meyer that is really, there's no movie quite like it. I couldn't even begin to describe it. But I'm sure your listeners out there have bumped into one or another of these movies or have heard of them. And then throughout the 70s, he made a handful of other pictures, most notably, I think, Super Vixens, which was maybe the most amped-up version of his sort of drive-in style, very funny, colorful, fast-moving piece of Americana that, you know, there's just nothing like it.
Well, that's a great overview of his career, and let's go back a little bit and
Certainly.
Sort of get this all pieced out here.
Okay.
He started his career as a combat photographer in World War II.
Right.
And that profoundly influenced the rest of his life.
Oh, you said it. I mean, he really looked at movies, making movies as an extension of his combat adventures. And believe you me, the people who were in them readily agreed. I mean, he'd take a cast and crew out to the middle of some godforsaken desert, and with six people, you know, a couple of strippers, some army buddies, and maybe even the occasional real actor, he'd grind out a movie. And he really, everybody said he was really sort of aping his adventures in the military, because that was really the formative experience that changed. I mean, it got him out of his home life, which from my research wasn't altogether the most happy, and it gave him an identity, it made him an adult, and you know, it introduced him to women for the first time overseas. So all that just sort of created an explosion in Russ's mind, and it led to many other things.
And there's a great story that goes along with his combat career, which helped to build up this Russ Meyer mythology, this self-built mythology of his.
Right.
And the story is about Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah, right. Meyer encounters Hemingway, and at the time, Hemingway was pals with a madam, and he felt for the combat photogs who were there, waiting to go into France, and kind of gave him the keys to the kingdom for a night. And Russ, who had not experienced this area of his manhood before, and in fact, from everything I could gather, was very kind of shy and intimidated by women up to this point, consummated the deal thanks to Ernest Hemingway, with a well-endowed a dame, and certainly that combined with a stripper that Meyer saw early on by the name of Margie Sullivan. These two events really had a big impact on his psyche. So, definitely. Sex and war were very interrelated for Meyer.
And once he got out of the war, he started doing industrial films, and that influence shows up as well in his
movies. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. John Waters, who was a great, great fan, friend, and I just obsessed with everything Meyer, called Meyer's picture Sex Industrials. And I think that's really an apt term, because you look at Meyer's pictures and there's just this unrelenting rat-a-tat-tat editing style, you know, a neon sign, a car fender, the inevitable breasts, a close-up of a pair of lips. And really, this is rooted in that industrial film style that he obviously became a master of, because he uses it to such diabolical ends in his filmmaking. It's just perfecto, in my opinion.
Well, there's one bit in the book where you talk about his editing style, and one of the rules, the laws, I guess, of the Meyer editing style was, don't show people blinking.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. Yeah, when I heard that, it just really kind of made me chuckle. Yeah, apparently he had a real mania for not showing any human being on screen blinking. He just thought it violated his aesthetic. And so at least one of his a couple people had told me, you know, it really was kind of one of the things that defined his editorial style, because if somebody was going to blink, he cut away. And in fact, one of his assistants would go to the movies while he worked for Meyer, and he went and saw some big Hollywood movie, and he said, man, there was a lot of blinking in that picture. It really, the editing wasn't very good. So, you know, once again, only Meyer could come up with this notion.
Well, besides the technical side, the editing and that sort of technical part of the movie making,
yeah,
he had this overarching philosophy, of which the title of your book sort of captures that: big bosoms and square jaws. That seemed to be a life philosophy of Meyer.
That's right. No, that was for him. That was the ingredients for a successful picture as made by Russ Meyer. And he certainly found, at least for him, when he deviated from that formula, it was big trouble.
Well, explain this formula, this philosophy, a little bit more.
Well, his movies are inhabited by odd representations of the male and female sexes. The women definitely all have big bosoms, and as time went on, had not only huge, but, I mean, frightening bosoms. I mean, it just got amped up to a degree that, as I think I put it in the book, eventually, you know, they became candidates for medical textbooks, not anything most of us maybe would associate with hot stuff. But at any rate, you have these very aggressive, demanding, just insanely driven and voracious women, And then you have the square jaws, which are these men who, there are usually two kind of figures of men in Meyer's films. And then the one who definitely didn't have a square jaw, it was invariably the husband who was being put upon by a wife with voracious sexuality that he could never satisfy. And this poor sap seems oblivious to her sexuality and incapable of satisfying her. And it's just a vicious picture of matrimony, in my opinion. And then you have guys like Charles Napier, who starred in some of his pictures, notably Cherry, Harry, and Raquel in Super Vixens. Boy, what a square jaw. Just playing these kind of psychopathic, amoral, diabolical guys who are out to take what they can get from the women, and the whole thing, it's amped up in a very violent and malevolent way. And I don't know if I explained it very well, but that gives you kind of a thumbnail of the characters in a Meyer movie.
Well, and it just wasn't the characters in these movies. It's sort of how he thought of life.
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd say so, definitely. And if you read the book, I think there's ample evidence that, yeah, indeed, this was no, you know, distant satire from his brain. This was really the way he saw life and lived it and behaved it and how he experienced people in it. And I think the more you study it, the more unusual it becomes. And the more you kind of delve into his life, the more resonant it becomes for all the oddness that is there.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, he started his movie career with The Immoral Mr. Tease, which was one of these groundbreaking films in that it basically started a whole genre called the Nudie Cutie.
Right.
That was infinitely imitated.
Yes.
And then he moved on to this darker period. That's quite a transition.
Yeah, no, I know. This is the great thing about Meyer. He was almost like an ad man with a product. It was like, well, you know, I've kind of exhausted this area. Now the great Meyer must take it into a new area, heretofore unseen, you know? I mean, it was great the way he just sort of, cliched expression, but reinvented himself, and he really did do it. And with this picture, Lorna, Mudhoney, Faster Pussycat, which I named, Motor Psycho, these were really very hard-boiled, down-and-dirty pictures, very, very grim, tough, and nothing like them, boy. I just think they're fantastic.
Well, it's during this period that he really found his place as a director, his style, his voice. You talk about in the book how he was in absolute control when filming a picture. He wanted to control everyone and everything, and God forbid somebody cross him.
He was an absolute, you know, he was a control freak. He was a dictator on the set. And, you know, it's interesting that two of the women who kind of rebelled the hardest against him, in my opinion, Tura Satan on the set of Faster Pussycat, Meyer forbade any sexual contact on the set of a picture. I mean, he wanted it just like, all these people were in bunkers, they belonged to him, you know, save your vital juices for the big screen. And that was it. And that was an order via Sergeant Meyer. And, two dames who definitely went against that, Tura and Faster Pussycat, who said, hey, you know, I need some male companionship on this set. You're not going to tell me no. And Meyer, you know, what was he going to do? She was going to split if he didn't acquiesce. And then on Vixen, Erica Gavin, who just an indescribably beautiful and high voltage creature, who also just by her very nature sort of defied Meyer. And I think those two performances are, you know, they're among the most interesting in Meyer's canon because of that very fact. These ones sort of play against the grain of his, you know, what is a very, you know, it's a very strict and severe, not only view of the world, but a way of making movies. And people who were there and talked about it, you know, they kind of shuddered remembering the experience, because you were definitely down in the trenches with old Russ, no question about it.
You're listening to an archived interview with Jimmy McDonough, author of Big Bosoms and Square Jaws, the biography of Russ Meyer, king of the sex film. We'll get back to the interview in just a moment, but first, McDonough just brought up the name of Erica Gavin, the woman who plays the insatiable Vixen in the movie of the same name. Here's a clip from that movie. In this scene, Vixen has just finished seducing the hapless constable in the forest.
I have to go.
So soon?
Don't grab my arm like that.
I'm sorry. But why must you leave so soon?
Because Tom's due any time now, stupido.
Can't you just stay for another half hour? I want to talk to you. Seriously.
So talk to me. Seriously.
Vixen.
Look, we've had our fun. Playtime is over, and now it's business as usual.
So this has just been fun and games to you? You bitch.
Come on, let's get dressed. You could do anything you wanted to me. What would you do?
Turn you over my knee and spank your bare butt.
What a funny policeman you are.
Come on, let's go.
That's a clip from Russ Meyer's 1968 film, Vixen. We now return to our interview with Meyer biographer Jimmy McDonough. Well, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, which you've mentioned, is probably the best of his films. A lot of people will argue it's the best of his films.
Right.
And it is a film that is also very much like a Russ Meyer film, but also very much unlike a Russ Meyer film.
Absolutely true, yeah. There's more going on in that picture, and boy... had Meyer been around to probe into his brain, I'd really like to know where that one came from, because it's so kind of, it's got all the elements of the other ones, but it's way out there.
There's violence, there's sex, there's fast cars, there's like all this tension and hip language and fast edits. Yeah.
And I think a couple of things he benefited from were... this guy, John Moran, who wrote the screenplay for that and a couple of other fantastic... He just had the gift of gab, man. This guy could nail the dialogue in a way that just had you shaking your head in wonder. And Richard Brummer, who came into the editing room and had experience in the art film area in New York, who amped up Meyer's editing style, showed him how to overlap dialogue. And really, if you look at the pictures that came before that, Faster Pussycat, man, it's just like, you know, he's just he switched gears and the engine's smoking, and it's a beautiful thing to watch.
And it's
there's
actually,
no picture like it.
No, there isn't, and it does have that art house quality because it's filmed in black and white, or as he liked to call it, filmed in black and blue.
Yeah, right.
But
yeah,
it does have that art film quality while being this out-and-out exploitation film, too.
I know. It's just sublime. It's such a combination of the high and low and left and right. And, you know, people who love that picture, you know, they really love it. And, boy, I'm one of them, definitely.
Well, then he moves on to back to color film, gorgeous color film.
Right.
And, as you said, amps up that sex and violence with films like Vixen.
Right.
Which was his next big hit.
Right. Yeah, Vixen is really, if you look at the script, it's kind of unremarkable in my opinion. It's kind of, you know, Meyer just grabs a former actor in a previous film and, you know, write this and, you know, probably locked him in a hotel room for 5 days and gave him, you know, $250. But it just benefits from the incorrigible presence of Erica Gavin, who just... is a presence like no other. It's so sad to me that she only made a few pictures, and didn't make any more because she's just, you know, she's a live wire. And there's something about the color in that picture. You can just, you can feel the sweat. It's just a, it's a great document of the time. Really great. And made so much money, just barrelfuls of money.
Earlier, you brought up the name of Roger Ebert.
Yeah.
A man who's actually very important to this area because he was born and grew up in this area and comes back every year to do a film festival.
Right.
How did he and Russ Meyer connect, get together?
Yeah, how did they, Jason? Well, Roger, being a great film fan, knew about Meyer from, you know, the days of the Immoral Mr. T's. And when Wall Street Journal did a profile on Meyer, really the emphasis was, you know, look at how much money this guy's making, being the Wall Street Journal, you know, by investing $1.98 and, you know, returning a thousandfold on that. But it was a cred, that article. It really kind of shined a light in what had, you know, previously been an area, you know, most of America would best consider under a rock. And Ebert wrote a letter, you know, saying, comparing Meyer to all these grand directors and saying, you know, it's about time Hollywood turned him loose. Well, Meyer, who was never one to miss anybody who loved him, got in touch with Ebert. And shortly thereafter, when Meyer was invited to 20th Century Fox, who but Ebert did he invite to write the script? And it has to be said, and both men have certainly said it, they both had a penchant for the same sort of big balcony dames, and that certainly sealed the deal, welded the friendship between RM and RE, as it were.
Well, Roger Ebert penned the famous film Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and that was the one he was credited for, but he actually hung around with Meyer for quite a while.
Oh, yeah.
And did a couple more films for
him.
Yes,
he did. All under pseudonyms. He contributed this crazed picture Up that Meyer did later in the 70s that really is kind of, I mean, even in Meyer terms, is kind of really unhinged. He contributed some monologues that Kitten Nativit had spouts that make no sense whatsoever. Wrote Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens, a great vehicle for Kitten. You know, and he contributed some stuff to Super Vixens. So he was around, and he was one of Meyer's cronies. And it was a beautiful thing at the funeral. Ebert stood up and eulogized his pal. And it was very moving to... you know, he said to me, you know, Meyer taught me how to embrace all the areas of my life. He said that you go out to dinner with Meyer and there would be, you know, a combat buddy, a stripper, a film critic, the guy from UPS, and whoever else bumped into the house at that day. And it really had, I think, a profound effect on Roger to say, you know, this is who I am. These are the things I like. Why compartmentalize your life and, you know, keep the strippers over here and the war buddies over there? And, you know, I think that's something profound to learn from somebody.
Well, what was the experience like for Russ Meyer in the big studio system?
Well, I think it was very good initially because, you know, he had everybody at his beck and call. I mean, amazingly... Zanuck and Brown, the producers there, Richard Zanuck, who was then head of the studio, and the studio was in trouble financially. They'd had all these big pictures that just went belly up. And they read this thing in the Wall Street Journal and thought, well, if this guy can get a return like that and times are changing, why don't we, you know, see what he can do for us? And they really gave him the keys to the kingdom. They gave him a big pile of loot. They said, go make your movie and bring it back to us. And, you know, I mean, for a former smut peddler to sort of be given, you know, for them to shine the Hollywood throne and say, sit here and what can we get you, Osire? It's unbelievable. I mean, it really is. And unfortunately, though, after that picture, I think instead of making what would be a Russ Meyer picture, he sort of went the other direction and sort of aped a Hollywood picture by making this picture The 7 Minutes, which, it has to be said, was kind of forced upon him. But it was this ponderous anti-censorship story based on a novel by Irving Wallace. And it had all the you know, he's never going to make a picture without talent. But it just, it really tanked. And that was definitely, other projects were discussed, but he left the studio soon after. And it's too bad that he couldn't have, you know, made a few more pictures in his own style. Who knows what would have happened? But the fact that he got away with one of them to the extent he did, it's just marvelous. And, you know, that's another picture. You mentioned that, and people, you know, they get all hushed and reverent and swoon because it means so much to the people who are into it.
Well, by the end of the 70s, Meyer was back on his own, back doing his own brand of ultra-violence and ultra-sex.
Right.
But it seemed like the rest of the popular culture was passing him by.
Yeah, yeah, I understandably so, too. I think you got to be a young man to keep on the sort of fads and to know which way the wind blows. And it was a much slower thing then. Nowadays, you know, things rise up and come to fruition and die, and it seems like a matter of hours in the media. But at this point, the studio, you know, Meyer had sort of busted down, you know, he'd been the big ape to sort of, you know, bust down the doors and, for everybody else to come through. He took all the chances. He was out there with his little picture, you know, and fighting censorship battles. He spent a lot of loot defending Vixen against, you know, these holier-than-thou right types who, you know, didn't like the smell of a Russ Meyer. And he always stood his ground that way. And now the studios were basically doing his trip, you know, and doing it with a lot more money and doing it with a astronomical budget for advertising and all that. And in addition to that, it was also the rise of the whole mall theaters where, you know, movie theaters were connected to shopping malls. These entrepreneurs wanted to keep the family experience front and center, so a picture like Meyer's, by its very nature rated X, the time had come and gone. And I think he was kind of wise to get out of it. Other guys might have, you know, stayed in there and gone down in flames. While he did spend a lot of times on this magnum opus that never came about, The Breast of Russ Meyer, which was, you know, by some accounts going to be, you know, 12 hours, 19 hours, I think by his own admission, the fire had kind of gone out of him. And he really kind of spent the rest of his days sort of the fetish of the big bosoms overtook his entire existence, it seems.
After his filmmaking career, there were a couple of things that obsessed him besides the other women in his life.
Right.
That was this autobiography that he was working on. And as you said, this huge film that never came about. But the autobiography was actually published.
Yeah, right, by Meyer himself. In a three-volume set. You can still get it from the estate. It's just this garage kind of aqua blue covered with gilt gold lettering with his signature, 1,000 pages plus. The pictures, he went to great pains to print the pictures a certain way. This became an obsession with him, this book. I mean, an obsession. And he kept changing it and adding to it. And the people who are working on it were confused as to which version they were working on. And the computers couldn't handle it because, you know, the versions they had were so old. And it got way into the land of insanity, and people were tearing their hair out just trying to get him to let go of the book. And I think, as some people put it in the book, I think, you know, finishing the book was a matter of facing his own mortality. The longer he could keep the book alive, you know, the longer he was occupied by a mission. So it's understandable. But, you know, it did finally come out, and it certainly is a document. I don't know if you're looking for insight or, you know, how Meyer feels about saving the whales. I don't think you're going to find it in the pages of A Clean Breast. But nonetheless, it's totally Meyer and completely fascinating on a number of levels.
And the title, A Clean Breast, was suggested to Meyer by Roger Ebert.
That's right, yeah. Who writes the introduction. And again, you know, I hand it to Ebert because, you know, when I talk to him, you know, I had some things to ask that maybe other people might have hung up on or punched me in the nose, but he was really a good sport about it and completely loyal to Russ. When other people, once they'd gotten a taste of mainstream success, that, you know, they might have wanted to distance themselves from the oeuvre of Russ Meyer. Not so with Mr. Ebert. I think it's really commendable.
Well, with the last decade or so, the cult status of Russ Meyer has really grown.
Oh, yeah. And I think it will continue. I hope it will continue to grow. Just because he's just one of these guys. He's just an American original. I mean, you say Russ Meyer picture and people, you know, people either applaud or vomit. I mean, they have an extreme reaction because there's nobody like the guy. And especially in this day and age where everything seems to be Batman 7 and Fantastic Four number 23. You know, not that there's anything wrong with those mega monster, you know, Hollywood cookie cutter, you know, movies. I mean, you look at something like Meyer, and he's just really like this, you know, this guy out there with his camera, his strippers, his army buddies, you know, and he's going to make a movie, no matter what. And, you know, I think people can look at it and get wistful for a lot of things that are harder and harder to find in America.
So with Meyer's passing, what's the current state of his film company and the films, and do you think that the mainstream movie industry will ever acknowledge him for who he was?
I don't know. Lifetime Achievement Award for Russ Meyer. You know, it's not out of the realm of the possible in this day and age. I just hope that his legacy is maintained in a way that keeps these pictures in the public eye so people don't have to go through rocks and valleys and bushes to find them. The amazing thing about Meyer is he held the rights to all but two of his pictures, the ones he made for Fox, and you could call him In the day when video cassettes came into being, you'd call RM Films and he'd take your call and you'd buy them directly from the master himself, you know, Meyer, and he'd tell you a few things about the film and, you know, just spout some inane philosophy a la Russ Meyer. And that was all good and great, but now, you know, we live in a big world and there's a lot of stuff out there, and I just would hope that there would be more avenues to get at his pictures, and they'd be seen more theatrically. But the whole estate he left is a very tangled web. I get into them in the book. It's not for me to paraphrase in 5 minutes because it's such an intricate tale. But one hopes that with his passing, maybe some of the dust in Meyer will clear, and his pictures will go on to live forever. Or something like that.
That was Jimmy McDonough, author of Big Bosoms and Square Jaws, the biography of Russ Meyer, King of the Sex Film. It's published by Crown Books. That interview was an extended interview from one that first aired on August Sidetrack, a program that airs here at 10 p.m. the first Wednesday of the month. We have a little time left, so let's finish this hour off with the theme to Russ Meyer's 1969 film, Cherry, Harry, and Raquel.
Do you have
Music from the Russ Meyer film Cherry, or Harry, Cherry, and Raquel. This afternoon, this is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Jason Croft, in for Celeste Quinn. Coming up in the 240 segment of the program today, another interview that was featured recently on Sidetrack. On this month's program, I talked with writer and musician Seb Hunter. His book, a memoir of his obsession with heavy metal music titled Hellbent for Leather, Confessions of a Heavy Metal Addict, has just been released in paperback. Now, one of Hunter's early influences was the band Kiss, and it doesn't take much of an excuse for me to play some Kiss here on the radio. So here is the band Kiss with Detroit Rock City. Detroit Rock City from the band Kiss, right here on the Afternoon Magazine. It's 10 minutes till 2 o'clock, and settlement prices should be in. And with the numbers, some of the numbers, here's Todd Gleason.
Checking the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade for the afternoon. We can take a look at those numbers very quickly and tell you that coming up during the closing market report this afternoon, we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana. The numbers look like this at the board as they finished up with the settlement prices for the day. They were a penny higher in the nearby December contract, 323 high, the low at 318 and a quarter. Settlement price there at 321 and a quarter. Once again, that December contract up a penny for the day. The March futures are 337 high, low at 332. Settlement price at $3.36. They were up one and a quarter on the day. And the May contract at 343.5, the high, the low at 339.5. Settlement price there at $3.43 and a quarter, since they were up two and a quarter. July contract in the wheat pit, 349.5, the high. Once again, that's 349.5, the low at 345.25. Settlement price at 348.75. They were up a penny and a half on the day. And the September futures in the wheat pit, $3.55 the high, the low at 52. Settlement price at $3.55 for September wheat, up 1.5. Corn futures narrowly mixed today. Nearly higher, actually, up a half cent in the December contract. The high at 207.5. Low there at 205.75. Settlement price 206.75, up a half. March contract 220.25. The high, the low at 218.5. Settlement price at 219.25. And they were up a quarter on the day. May futures, a 227 high, low at 225.75. Settlement price at 226.75, up a half. And July futures at 233.5 high, low at 232.25. Settlement price at 233.25, up 0.75. September corn, 239.75, the high, the low at 39.25. Just a half cent trading range, but finished on the top side of that at $2.39.75 for the September corn next year, up a half. And next year's December contract, up a half as well. Settled at 248.5. The high was 48.75. The low at $2.48. December oats, 157.5. The high for the day. The low at 155.75. Settlement price at 157.25. They were up 1/2. And the March contract at 163 high. Low at 162. Settlement price at $1.63. They were up 1/2. Soy complex now. November beans, 578.5. The high, the low at 569.25. Settlement price at $5.72. They were down 4 on the day. January futures off 4.25. 587, the high, the low at 578. Settlement price for that January contract in the bean pit at $5.81 a bushel. Once again, it was down 4.25 for the day. March contract down 4 cents, 594, the high, the low at $5.85. Settlement price at 588.25. The March soybeans off 4. May contract 599, the high, the low at 91.5. A settlement price at $5.92. They were off 4.5. And July futures in the bean pit, 602, the high, the low at 595.5, settlement price at 598. They were down 3.25. August futures, 596, the high, the low at 594.25, and a settlement price for the August soybeans next summer, $5.95.5. They were off 3.5 for the day. Bean meal futures, October contract, 174.20, the high, the low at 171.70. And a settlement price at $172.30. They were off $1.20 for the day. December futures in the bean oil, $176.90. The high, the low at $174.50. And the settlement price at $175.20. They were off $1 for the December bean meal. Bean oil futures, $22.72 the high. Low at $22.32. Settlement price there at $22.45, off $27. And December bean oil, $22.96 the high. The low at $22.55. Settlement price at $22.70. They were down 28 for the day. I'll return at 6 after the hour during the closing market report. We'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana. And we'll check the crop progress reports as they were released from the United States Department of Agriculture, National Agricultural Statistics Service yesterday afternoon. About 11% of the corn crop is in the bin nationwide, now 8% of the soybeans. We'll get the complete numbers from the state statisticians in Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota. Those are the top 5 corn-producing states in the United States. Now, here are the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. We'll start now with feeder cattle. Cattle was down today, and hogs were up. September feeder cattle, the high, 115.15, the low 114.45, settled at 114.47.5, down 62.5. October 113.50, the high 112.70, the low 112.95, the settlement down 50. November feeder cattle 112.62.5, the high 112.15, the low settled at 112.25, a change of 57.5. Moving on to October live cattle, the high today 86.07.5, the low 85.52.5, settled at 85.82.5, down 25. December live cattle, the high today 88.35, the low 87.77.5, settled at 88.20, down 20. Moving on to lean hogs for October, 65.85, the high 64.70, the low 65.77.5, the settlement that up 80. December lean hogs, the high 63.20, the low 62.05, settled at 63.12.5, that up 82.5. February lean hogs, 64.25, the high, 63.50, the low, 64.20, the settlement, that up
42.5. Lean hogs for April, 63.20 the high, 62.10 the low, 63.02.5 the settlement. That up 57.5. Moving on to frozen pork bellies for February, the high 82.85, the low 81.50. Settled at 82.85, that up 200. For March, the high price, 82.80. There was no low, so that was just the settlement price, and then up 200. Those are the numbers from the Merck.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming on AM 580 as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists, on the web at a6395.com and at agrigold.com.
Checking Wall Street at this moment, the Dow is down 14 points at 10,546. The NASDAQ is up just over 7 points at 2152, and the S&P is up a fraction of a point to 1231. It's 81 degrees outside. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine here on AM 580, WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Looking at the forecast for this afternoon, courtesy of meteorologist Ed Kieser for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon, in the north, sunny in central and southern sections, a mix of clouds and sunshine, highs ranging from 78 near Lake Michigan to 90 in far southern Illinois. For tonight, clear with patchy fog forming, lows ranging from 53 in east central Indiana to 61 in southwestern Illinois. For tomorrow, sunny and warm, highs ranging from 82 in northeastern Indiana to 92 in southwestern Illinois. The extended forecast for Illinois and Indiana for Thursday in the north, partly sunny with scattered showers and thunderstorms. In central sections, partly to mostly sunny. In the south, sunny. Friday and Saturday, a mix of clouds and sunshine with scattered showers and thunderstorms. Highs Thursday ranging from the 70s in far northern Illinois to the 90s south. Highs Fridays and Saturdays generally ranging from the 70s north to the 80s south. Lows through the period in the mid-50s to the mid-60s. For this afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny, the high 83, winds light and variable. For tonight, clear with some patchy fog forming overnight, the low 57, winds light and variable. For tomorrow, sunny and warm, the high 87, winds southerly at 6 to 12 miles an hour. For tomorrow,